Hi, you're listening to Let's Talk Chemistry, a podcast by ChemTalk. On today's episode, we interview Dr. Thomas Albert Schoenzart, a professor of chemistry at the Colorado School of Mines. He shares with us today about the world of radiochemistry and his current research. We hope you enjoy.
Hi, welcome back to another episode of Let's Talk Chemistry. I'm Jason, one of your hosts, and today I'm joined by
Neo. Today, we'll be looking into the world of transuranium elements and radiochemistry with our guest, Dr. Thomas Albrecht Schoenzart.
I'm super excited to dive into his exciting journey and work. First, let's hear a bit about his background.
My name is Thomas Albrecht Schoenzart. My educational background is I did my undergraduate degree in chemistry at Southwest Minnesota State University. I went from there to Northwestern University, where I did my master's degree and my PhD. They're just concurrent with each other. And then I went from there to do a postdoc at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign.
So what exactly is it that Dr. Albert Schoenzart researches?
Well, he is a radiochemist who focuses heavily on heavy elements like berkelium and californium. The heavy elements can be difficult to study due to their radioactive nature. So his lab looks to elucidate the chemical and physical properties. Let's hear more from him.
I work broadly in radiochemistry, but more specifically, we focus on the chemistry of the heaviest elements that one can study with sort of semi-standard macroscopic techniques.
His path into the field of radiochemistry is nonlinear as well.
In a very nonlinear way. So I'm trained in as a very classical inorganic chemist, a coordination chemist. I did a lot of X-ray crystallography, some heteronuclear NMR, but my background is much more in noble metal chemistry, especially things like rhodium and iridium. But when I was a graduate student, I was fortunate enough to overlap with a postdoc who was a theoretician, and he introduced me to thermoelectric materials, which these are the materials that convert heat into electricity. And so the current Martian rover that's running around, it has kilograms of plutonium-238, which produces a lot of thermal heat, and they use thermoelectric materials to convert that heat into electricity. And that's actually what runs that rover. And so I got really interested in this. And I loved the idea from the time I was a child of working with NASA. And so when I started my own independent career, I decided I wanted to work on thermoelectrics and I wanted to develop new materials. And the material that we targeted was uranium arsenide. And I had very little experience with uranium chemistry, really just a few reactions from graduate school. And we really struggled. You really need to make large single crystalline samples to do a lot of the physical property measurements that you want to do. And we had to learn all new techniques for crystal growth. And what ended up happening is rather than the focus being new thermoelectric materials or more efficient materials, the uranium became the focus. And that led us down the rabbit hole to heavier and heavier and heavier actinides for a wide variety of both applied and very fundamental reasons.
Dr. Albert Schoenzart's path shows how expansive the field of chemistry is. Even with a strong background in inorganic chemistry, he had to gain years of experience to break into the field of radiochemistry.
Yeah, I agree. The field is so wide and there's an infinite amount of applications of chemistry. That's what makes it so exciting.
Radiochemistry has two quite different definitions. The historic definition is radiochemistry was really a reference to following chemical reactions by tracking the radiation. And in fact, many early reaction mechanisms, maybe the majority of early reaction mechanisms, were done with elements like carbon-14, for example. That was a, you know, if you were doing a carbonyl displacement reaction, you know, back in the 1950s and 60s, NMR wasn't available, at least not readily available. You would have followed it with radiation by following radioactive carbon-14. Today, I think it is a much broader definition in that radiochemistry is simply the chemistry of radioactive elements. And so it encompasses, you know, traditional pulse radiolysis and ionizing type radiation experiments. But it also includes people like me who are really inorganic chemists studying the chemistry of radioactive elements. And sometimes we are specifically studying the effects of the radiation, but more often than not, it's a shame that they're radioactive because it would be a lot easier if they were stable.
Wow. It's very interesting to see how the definition of radiochemistry has changed over the decades.
Like the definition, the field of radiochemistry has changed massively over time.
So all things nuclear went through what a lot of us call the valley of death in the early 1980s. So, you know, the Three Mile Island incident occurred in the 70s, in the late 70s, during the Carter administration. And this really put a chill on all things nuclear. And then, you know, in the mid 80s, you had the Chernobyl incident, which was really a horrific incident by comparison to Three Mile Island. And when you couple that with, there was a huge rise in interest in other forms of energy generation. And there was definitely a decrease in interest in nuclear medicine, which has been one of the primary driving forces for all types of radiochemical studies. And so when all of this came together, what you entered into was a period of time that spanned the 80s and the 90s almost entirely, where no new labs were built, very few PhDs were granted in almost any kind of nuclear related field. And so it was really against a lot of advice that I went into radiochemistry, because, you know, I started in 1998, really at the tail end of this, but still very much within the valley of death. And people are like, look, this is a dead field. Like, what are you doing? You know, you're just getting started and this field is dying.
It makes sense why nuclear and radiochemistry were at a standstill during this time.
Yeah. Politics and history can be key players in many fields of science, even beyond radiochemistry. In the past couple of decades, we have seen a reemergence of radiochemistry.
And we began graduating some of the first new PhDs in radiochemistry, because in the intervening 25 years, just the nuclear renaissance that everybody was predicting would occur is occurring now. And it's being driven by many things. You know, nuclear medicine has really taken off, especially because of the drug Zofigo, which is a radium-based drug that's used for treating metastatic prostate cancer. But it's one of dozens of different potential drugs. It's licensed and being used to save people, but there are many other candidates, and that field is just growing exponentially. But also, you know, even the staunchest conservatives now will begrudgingly admit that we have major climate change, you know, effects going on right now. And the only high energy density form of energy that doesn't have a large carbon footprint is nuclear. And so the other thing you're seeing right now is, you know, we know that building the old timey gigantic, you know, gigawatt sized reactors is extremely expensive and extremely slow and requires a very long and expensive investment that a lot of investors don't want to make. But small modular reactors, of which the first one will come online, I think, next year, the MARVEL reactor at Idaho National Lab. But there are many, many different designs by both private industry and government, private industry ventures, coupled ventures, that are really also driving this forward. But, you know, from my perspective, I mostly work on fundamental science.
The Valley of Death was not a complete standstill for the field. While no new research was being done, the general field of inorganic chemistry continued to advance.
What's happened, you know, many of these isotopes were discovered by 1950, most of the actinides were discovered. You know, californium and berkelium were both reported in 1950. And so you would think that their chemistry would be developed. But if you think about, okay, what techniques were available in 1950, and almost none of the techniques we have today, especially at a commercialized level, were available. You know, you couldn't, doing one single crystal structure would have been an epic undertaking for an entire research group, you know, and now, you know, you can do four or five single crystal structures a day with a normal instrument. You know, things like NMR and Raman spectroscopy, all the normal techniques you're thinking of, they weren't available when these isotopes were discovered. And so now what we can do is we can take these really fascinating elements for which very little is known and apply modern instrumentation, modern synthetic methods, and modern theory, which is really good now, to understand what's going on with these elements. And they really, they defy a lot of predictions. And so you need to understand why they defy predictions. And that's really what a lot of my research is dedicated to.
Diffractometer, absorption spectra, microspectric photometer, Raman spectroscope.
It sounds complicated, but these are all techniques and tools used in inorganic chemistry. A diffractometer uses an instrument that uses the principles of diffraction on an area detector to create a pattern. The pattern can then be used to determine the structure of the material it was used on. The absorption spectra shows what wavelength of electromagnetic radiation a material absorbs or transmits. And a microspectric photometer is an instrument used to determine the spectra. A Raman microscope is a device used to perform a similar type of spectroscopy that uses lasers to help determine the structure.
Okay, that makes a lot more sense now. Our previous guest, Dr. George Schatz, on episode 30, used Raman spectroscopy to study nanoparticles. It's super cool to see the same technique come up in a different area of research.
I agree. And it's also super cool to see how a field that was at a standstill for so long bounces back into the spotlight.
I couldn't agree more. I wonder if Dr. Schoenzart has any insights into how radiochemistry is intertwined with our everyday lives.
He does. Let's hear right from him.
I'll give an example that one hopes that it's not your day-to-day, but nuclear medicine is definitely going to be one of the driving forces. So there are a number of actinides, beginning with actinium. So actinium-225 is a very promising radiotherapy agent. You could move on from there to things like thorium-228, which is similarly very promising. There are later elements which have been used in nuclear medicine, like californium-252, which is a very powerful neutron emitter that has been used to destroy tumors. So that's the first application that hopefully does not affect somebody in day-to-day life, but it would be nice if you have that as an option. But if we, you know, return full circle to the revolutions in nuclear energy, some of these really high burn-up scenarios where you take fuel and you have a very high neutron flux for much longer periods of time actually generate more of the heavy actinides than you would find in a normal light water reactor. And so one needs to develop techniques for selectively extracting those. You know, when it's time to recycle the fuel, you want to be able to pull them out and put them into new fuel and either use them as fission sources, or if they're not useful as an energy source and they're more of a neutron poison, you want to develop materials that you can store them safely on geologic timescales so that they don't enter into the environment ever. And so some of the immediate applications is developing resilient waveforms that trap radionuclides for really long periods of time. They would also have applications in nuclear medicine. Those are going to be the primary areas that you're going to use them for everyday life, is recycling used nuclear fuel and really treating cancer. Those are the two main scenarios.
You know, it's so interesting how radiochemistry can be applied to nuclear medicine and nuclear fuel.
Yeah, for sure. Though I had a hard time understanding the nuclear applications of radiochemistry. You mind breaking it down?
Yeah, of course. So firstly, nuclear chemistry is the study of radioactive elements and their applications. In his explanation, Dr. Schoenzart referred to high burnup scenarios, which are situations where nuclear fuel, typically in a nuclear reactor, has undergone an extended period of irradiation.
Okay, I follow. But what exactly do neutrons and neutron flux have to do with this?
Great question. Neutron flux plays an important role in the nuclear reactions that occur within a nuclear reactor, and it is directly related to burnup. So neutrons are these tiny particles inside an atom's nucleus, which carry no charge and contribute to the atom's mass. And they are responsible for initiating nuclear fission reactions in fuel nuclei.
Mm-hmm. So if fuel nuclei are the nuclei of the atoms that are being used for fuel, what exactly does nuclear fission do?
So basically, when a neutron collides with the nucleus of a fuel atom, it starts a process called nuclear fission, which causes the atom's nucleus to become unstable, splitting it into two or more smaller fragments while releasing a massive amount of energy at the same time. This process is like a chain reaction that occurs all over the reactor.
Okay, that covers neutrons, but what about neutron flux?
So neutron flux refers to the rate at which neutrons pass through a unit area. And in high burnup scenarios, the neutron flux is typically higher. And the combination of a high neutron flux with a prolonged exposure to neutrons, which is the extended period of radiation Dr. Schoenzart talked about, leads to the accumulation of heavy actinides in nuclear fuel, an example being plutonium.
Thanks. That makes a lot more sense now. But I'm still confused. I know what heavy actinides are used for, thanks to Dr. Schoenzart, but what exactly is a heavy actinide?
So heavy actinides are isotopes of their respective actinides. Heavy actinides are produced mainly through neutron capture, which is when neutrons produced in nuclear fission reactions are absorbed by other atomic nuclei, making them heavier.
Thanks for the explanation. Knowing how these heavy actinides are made, trapping these radioactive nuclei safely with efficient energy storage makes a lot more sense.
Yeah, no worries. So with all these different applications of radiochemistry, I wonder what work Dr. Schoenzart does in this field and what he does day to day.
Me too. Let's hear right from him.
So on a day-to-day basis, these elements are rare and they're extremely valuable. And you tend to work with, not tend to, you always work with very small quantities. And so, you know, a large scale reaction with californium would have 5 milligrams of californium content. And so on a day-to-day basis, what we have to do is find elements that are chemically similar to californium. You'll never find something that's identical because every element is different, but some of the lanthanides are chemically quite similar to californium. And because the californium's so valuable, we have to really choreograph all of these experiments with non-radioactive analogs until we've perfected the synthesis at a reasonable scale, say maybe 100 milligram scale. And then we have to scale it down to what we're going to be using when we work with the radioisotope. And then we have to perfect it at that scale. And then we have to perfect crystal growth at that scale. And then if it's something really exotic, you know, we go beyond californium, einsteinium, and fermium. When you're doing those experiments, those have to be choreographed and executed at an even higher level. And so there's sometimes more than a year of work goes into making one late actinide compound. And what's really neat about that year of work that you've put into maybe growing an einsteinium crystal or maybe doing a mass spec experiment on fermium, that's all valuable, publishable data. And so, in fact, even though an element like samarium is extraordinarily well studied for all kinds of different purposes, we found some really fundamental surprises in samarium's chemistry. Like, for instance, it's well known that samarium plus two, which is a very common reagent used in organic chemistry as a reductant, it photoluminesces in the red or the near IR. And it turns out that, you know, that's something that should have been very well studied. But it turns out its photoluminescence will switch between very, very sharp line-like F-F transitions and broadband F-D transitions based on the temperature that you're making the measurement at. And it turned out people didn't know that. And so, you know, we were able to make the observation, show the interconversion from F to D to F, and show the origin of it as well. And so the work with the lanthanide analogs or early transition metal analogs, it's valuable as a standalone study. And, you know, it informs what we need to do with the actinides, but it results in nice discoveries in and of itself.
Wow. All these little steps Dr. Schoenzart takes to get the most out of every sample and eventually making the actinide compound is so fascinating.
I totally agree. And the possible discoveries that could be made while studying these samples, like how Dr. Schoenzart realized that samarium 2 plus's photoluminescence depends on temperature.
You know, speaking of his day-to-day, I wonder if Dr. Schoenzart has any recent projects or publications.
He does. And Dr. Schoenzart shared his current project during his interview.
Yeah, so one of the areas that's really captivating me right now is high-pressure studies. So we take these crystals of either molecular systems or moth-like systems or sometimes much more condensed matter systems like a uranium arsenide, for example. And we put them between two diamonds. They're actually like 1-carat diamonds like you'd have in a solitaire ring, except the tip would be chipped off or cut off. And you place your crystal in the middle of a little metal gasket like a donut. Diamonds go on either side of the gasket. And with the right holder for that, you can then compress the crystal that's in between the diamonds. So that's just called diamond anvil techniques. And again, that's another one of these techniques that used to be entirely in the geologist domain. They were the ones that really pioneered that. And now when you buy a single crystal instrument, you can get diamond anvil cell as part of the options that comes with the instrument. It's still a very challenging technique to do correctly. Just because you buy your diamond anvil cell doesn't mean you know how to do the experiment. So we've invested at this point more than 7 years in our diamond anvil work. And what's really neat is when you have materials that have taken so long to perfect the synthesis and crystal growth, and they're so time limited because radiation is going to destroy them, especially with a short-lived isotope, really quickly. What you want to be able to do is, when you have a really good synthesis and a really good crystal growth, is do as much as you can with that material, right? And especially if you've gone through the trouble to make it a super reproducible high yield, well, then you want to keep, you know, harvesting as much as you can from those samples. And so we've taken these crystals, we've pressurized them to pressures that are higher than in the crust of the earth. So we've crossed the crust mantle boundary a little bit, and we plan to go much higher and go deeper into the mantle. I mean, you know, by comparison, not literally. And when you do that, when you compress these samples, they exhibit really fascinating changes. So, you know, you're shortening bond distances, which means you're engaging orbitals and bonding that maybe weren't involved in bonding before. And the physical properties can change really dramatically. And so you're making the bonds more covalent. You're taking the unpaired electrons in the metal and delocalizing them out over the molecules to a greater degree. And that really affects the bulk properties. And so we're going to take this one step further over the next couple of years and try to access unknown oxidation states, try to access phases that you absolutely wouldn't be able to make under ambient conditions using this technique. So we're building two new capabilities at high pressures. One is what's called an old multi-anvil press, where you can, instead of just doing one crystal between two diamonds, you can actually synthesize a bulk sample. It takes a rather large apparatus to do that. And the other is, if you stack diamonds on top of each other, you have one diamond pushing on a smaller diamond below it. That's when you know, the geologists have gotten to the pressures that are at the center of the sun that way. And, you know, you can really change chemistry and physics under those kinds of conditions. So that's one of the areas that we're currently really pushing hard on.
Wow. It's so cool to learn that Dr. Schoenzart can use the diamond anvil technique to achieve mantle-like pressure and study samples under these conditions. The physical properties of substances under the conditions caused by the diamond anvil change dramatically. I wonder what the applications could be.
Great question. Dr. Schoenzart touched on the applications of high-pressure studies during the interview and included accessing unknown oxidation states and phases unobtainable under regular conditions.
Okay, I follow. But how exactly can these unknown oxidation states and phases be helpful?
So oxidation states refer to the hypothetical charge given to an atom. With the discovery of new oxidation states via high-pressure studies, applications could range from electronic, as different oxidation states of semiconducting materials are crucial in electronic devices, to water treatment, as different oxidation states of manganese can remove contaminants in water.
Yeah, that makes sense. But what about accessing different phases that wouldn't be attainable under normal conditions?
So phases in materials refers to the different forms of states of matter like solid, liquid, or gas. When we talk about accessing phases that couldn't be obtained under normal conditions, it means creating or discovering new forms of materials that have special properties. This is important because these unique materials can be used in various applications, like in energy conversion devices. By understanding and manipulating these different phases, researchers can optimize for efficient energy conversion.
Thanks. That makes a lot more sense.
No problem. Also, because the diamonds are put under these extreme pressures, is it possible for them to break?
I'm not sure. Let's hear what Dr. Schoenzart has to say about this.
You can break diamonds. It's nothing violent. You just hear a crack that makes you sick to your stomach. So you could type sound and you're like, oh, right? Because that was a one carat diamond splitting in half, right? And so the good news is that the diamonds, which are ethically sourced, that's step number one. We're not paying jewelry store prices. So it's not, it's not as financially catastrophic if you crack a diamond.
Wow. So diamonds can crack. It's at least reassuring that radiochemists like Dr. Schoenzart don't have to pay jewelry store prices.
Yeah, for sure. You know, all of Dr. Schoenzart's research sounds like a lot of work.
Yeah, working in a team definitely seems like the way to go. But I'm curious, does Dr. Schoenzart have any advice about collaborating in a scientific setting?
Absolutely. Let's hear his advice.
I guess it was in 2017, we published a paper on four different berkelium compounds. And those were actually, they were the third, fourth, fifth, and sixth Berkelium structures ever produced. And as a matter of fact, most of that same team was part of a paper in Science that was published just before that, which had the very first two Berkelium crystal structures in there. And those papers had something like 31 authors from 10 different, or I think it was 11 different institutions. And I'm really proud of that, because if you look in that list of people, there's, you know, what I wanted to do is I said, look, you know, this is maybe the first and last time we're going to be able to do these studies, because you don't know how frequently the Department of Energy is going to supply you with berkelium. And so, you know, I'm like, we have to bring in the world's best people that are willing to work on this problem while we have this isotope, because it's a very short-lived isotope. And so, you know, we had some of the world's best spectroscopists. We had, even though my group has a lot of expertise in crystallography, we have good friends that have crystallographic skills that we lack, and we brought them in to help. And we brought in five different theory groups that have different areas of expertise. You know, some are more on the condensed matter side and can handle periodic structures better. Others use advanced, you know, crystal field fitting methods, and others use, you know, all electron, fully relativistic, fully spin orbit coupled wave function methods. And what was really neat is when you brought all that together, it told a really coherent story. And so, you know, there is no other way to conduct radiochemistry than to do it collaboratively. It's just, it's impossible. And if you try to do it as an isolated group, what's going to happen is the compounds are going to be not as well characterized as they would be if you brought in a big team. On the theory side, you probably will have a very limited theoretical understanding of the underpinnings of bonding and spectroscopy in the compound. And you're going to have a lot of missed opportunities. And you don't know when the opportunity to work with that isotope is going to arise again, right? And so I think that's one of the greatest things about radiochemistry is we're a relatively small community. We all know each other. And for the most part, we get along really well, and we all help each other. So it's very common for me to get an email from somebody saying, hey, you know, I need help with this structure, or, you know, we need to make a magnetism measurement. Can I send one of my postdocs to your lab, you know, to do this measurement, or vice versa? Like, you know, I need an XF study. Can I please send one of my graduate students out with a sample, you know, the next time you have bean time? And that's the way the community works. And it's a really healthy and vibrant and exciting community. And, you know, so that's one of the reasons why so many young scientists want to be a part of it, is they recognize that the valley of death is long in the past. And this is, you know, a period of exponential growth right now. So this is a great time to be a radiochemist.
Wow. I can see just how important working in a group is now. Radiochemistry is a collaborative field, and working in big teams is sure to be helpful.
Yeah, I agree completely. But are there also challenges in working in such a large group?
Great question. Dr. Schoenzart spoke about this topic, so let's hear from him.
There's two big challenges. Challenge number one is whenever you're working with radioactive material, it's safety first. And so you spend a lot of time ensuring that your researchers get certainly the smallest dose possible, but preferably zero. And so, you know, we've instituted all kinds of protocols to really help with this. For instance, you know, there are federal limits for radiation doses for the average person. And we take those federal limits and we multiply them by 10% for students. And we've never hit that 10%. And doing that when you're working with elements as radioactive as californium is challenging. We think that that's the only way to do it. And so there's a lot of time spent dealing with safety, writing safety operating procedures, choreographing experiments. And so that's a huge responsibility and a huge commitment that if someone isn't willing to make, they really can't go into radiochemistry. It's you either do it safely or you don't do it at all. So the other part of it is when you're coordinating a large team, what you'll often discover is that you have a good problem and that everybody wants to work on it. And so, you know, you have to arrange the teams so that so that young researchers stay engaged and are excited about their contribution, and but also so that they're not making duplicative contributions. Like, you don't want two people working on the exact same thing unless the purpose of doing that is simply to replicate the experiment. And then in that case, it's fine and necessary. The other thing you want to make sure is that everybody understands their role and how essential their role is. So nobody can say, well, you know, the day that the Berkeley MRI is this morning, I'm going to sleep in. You know, that's not going to be, that's a non-option. So making sure you have a committed team and that it's, that everybody understands their role and that, that everybody understands that their role is important is critical to getting the experiments accomplished.
Absolutely. I thought it was amazing how much Dr. Schoenzart emphasizes safety by using 10% of the federal limits for doses in the lab, combined with him saying, either do it safely or don't do it at all.
Yeah. Also, considering the diverse applications of radiochemistry and research, how do we go about effectively communicating scientific concepts to a broader audience?
I'm thinking the same thing. Luckily, Dr. Schoenzart is also a distinguished lecturer, so let's hear what he has to say.
I think there's a couple of important things is you have to know your audience. So if I'm going to Los Alamos National Lab, where, you know, a significant concentration of the world experts in actinide chemistry are, that's a very different lecture. That's going to be a deep dive, as opposed to if I'm going to go give some endowed lecture at some famous university, where I'll have everything from freshman gen chem students all the way through, you know, your most famous people, but really every field is represented. And so, you know, you need to pitch the topic at a technical enough level that you keep people that really need details engaged, but you don't want to get into the weeds so much that the brand new scientists get lost because they don't even understand the language you're using. So I try to find a middle ground to pitch things at. And the other thing is, and this may sound trivial today with everybody taking pictures all the time, but, you know, we were one of the early groups to photograph everything. So if you look at RSIs, there's pictures of the starting reactions and the intermediate stages and the end of the reaction and the crystals and the degraded crystals, and everything is photographed. And I can then take those photographs and put them in the talk. So, you know, when I'm talking about, you know, a californium crystal that's radioluminescing, meaning it's glowing green, I have a photograph of the crystal glowing green. And, you know, if that crystal has become radiation damaged and turned brown and crumbled apart, I have a picture of that too. And so rather than me just verbally describing it, you know, the cliche is a picture says 1,000 words. Well, you know, it's, I think, incorporating as much photography as you can and avoiding cartoons, no matter how well they're executed technologically, the picture really says a lot more. So I try to have as much of that as I can.
Well, knowing your audience is such an important factor when communicating scientifically to either experts or beginners.
I agree. And providing many resources to help with comprehension, like photographs and figures, is essential to communicate complicated science effectively and thoroughly. Now that our time with Dr. Albert Schoenzart is coming to an end, I wonder if he has any general advice for students or young scientists.
I have a couple pieces of advice. One is, you need to, if you're committed to being a scientist, you need to find an area that you're passionate about. It's not just enough to be intellectually talented, or even enough if it's a field that few people can grasp. That's still not enough. You know, science is hard. You know, we're trying to develop new knowledge. And if that knowledge was easy to get at, somebody would have already discovered it. And so you always have to think about that. Oh, if this was easy to discover, it would already be discovered. And so you're going to be doing hard things that will sometimes take years to accomplish. And so if you don't have that fire in the belly, that inner passion to stick with the study, you probably won't finish, or you'll probably get distracted and go off and work on something else.
The juxtaposition between being a rational thinker while working with an inner passion is definitely something interesting to think about. Here's another piece of advice he wanted our listeners to hear.
The other thing I would say is, even though it is very critical that that you become an expert, you know, in a very deep way, in a very specific area, you should expose yourself to as many fields and disciplines within your field as you can, because you'll be surprised at the insight that you'll get from a lecture that you would have never thought was interesting, or a solution to a problem that you've been banging your head against the wall about. Suddenly somebody has the explanation up in a talk that's not even vaguely related to your area. That will happen a lot, but it takes a commitment to stay engaged to science broadly.
That makes sense. It can be really useful to keep an open mind.
Yeah. And even though science can be difficult, Dr. Albrecht Schoenzart's passion for radiochemistry has been clearly shown through our conversation with him.
I agree. I gained a lot of insight into radiochemistry, and I hope our listeners have too.
Through the Valley of Death to the Renaissance of Radiochemistry, Dr. Albrecht Schoenzart has done extensive work on elements like berkelium. Looking deep into the structure and properties of these transuranium elements in this episode of Let's Talk Chemistry.
As a final note, thank you, Dr. Thomas Albrecht Schoenzart, for sharing your insights and stories with us.
And with that being said, this has been your number one source of talking chemistry, Chem Talk. Until next time, bye.
Thank you for listening to Let's Talk Chemistry, a podcast by Chem Talk. We hope you enjoyed it. For more information on today's episode and countless chemistry resources, please visit our website at www.chemistrytalk.org.